Yep, ready.
Technology. This week, it's been an interesting week in the sense that people have written to me and people have said to me, please will you pray for my friend, my grandmother. And then two people from here, an old friend of mine, Sue Shears, and Lizzie was talking about a child of someone she knows, an 8-year-old child. It doesn't really matter, young or old, we're always faced with the possibility of death. And so, as I said, this week four people have come to my notice and I've been asked to pray or help them in some way go through this transition of what we call the Vada. And each one of them, I'm sure they weren't expecting to die so soon at that moment. So we need to be prepared, and I always ask myself, ask those around me, are you ready? Are you really ready to go today? You know, we talk a lot, but you know, are we really ready to let go of everything that we know? I think most of us are not. And so this is one reason why we listen to these teachings and we practice, so that we can be able to let go of this attachment to this body that we have now. You know, because this is how we relate to ourselves and life. This is me. I am this body. And then from this idea of me and my body, then everything else arises as other. Other than me. And we're trying to understand, you know, how we're so entrenched in this illusion of there being something here, perceiving something out there, how this has become such a habit that we can't see another way. We can't see the possibility that there is another way of seeing, which doesn't depend on this dualistic fixation of me or I and everything else. Okay, let's just wait a minute. So it's very good to contemplate death, not as something morbid or negative, but as part of life. Every day one should consider the possibility of dying. And then that really helps you to make use, to utilize your daily life as your path. Otherwise, we have this idea that practice is, you know, something that we do when we have time, isn't it? We don't see life as practice and practice as life. We don't see it that way. You know? There's a time to practice and then everything else is, you know, well, I'm just getting on with my life. It doesn't have to be that way. We're wasting an opportunity that we have. So, helpful. Just spend a few moments every day considering death. Considering the possibility that maybe today might be your last day. And this will help in many different ways to let go of things that you are very attached to now. Little things that cause a lot of problems in your life, but you don't see how they're causing you problems. You don't see how this attachment to these things is causing you a lot of frustration, dissatisfaction, all kinds of agitation. We don't see. Because we put a value on certain things. We give things value that really don't have value at all. We don't see the futility of what we're doing. We expect results from what we're doing. We expect that somehow this is going to give me the pleasure and the happiness that I'm looking for. And when it doesn't give us what we're looking for, then we feel very frustrated and very dissatisfied because we've given this thing in our mind some value that it really doesn't have. We believe by following whatever pursuit it is, you know, that is what is going to give me what I'm looking for. So last week I asked you, you know, for the new year, I said, write down a list of priorities for yourself. What, you know, be honest with yourself. What are your priorities in life? You know, what do you consider most important? Second, third, fourth, fifth. It's very interesting to do this, you know, because you learn a lot about how you're going to utilize your time. If you consider feeling good and pleasure to be the most important thing in your life, then that's what you're going to be looking for. This is why you're going to orientate your life to finding things that make you feel good. And then anything that irritates you, you're going to push away from you. You won't want to deal with it because your idea is to feel good and find pleasure. Your idea is not to learn from whatever is arising in your life. If that is your priority, then you will utilize whatever is happening. All those little irritations, they will be just as valuable to you as the pleasure and the good times that we're looking for. So see how you're orientating yourself, and then you will learn from your orientation. Very, very helpful. Check your motivation, why you're here. And as I've said many times before, if you're looking for pleasure, if that's your motivation, and you come here and you feel you feel insecure, you feel uncomfortable, you feel bored, then you know you're going to push these things away from you. You're not going to learn from the experience of whatever arises. But if you come here to work with your own confusion, then whatever arises is your own path. It's your journey, it's your discovery, a journey of discovery. This is what we're walking. This is our path. It's not something rigid. Whatever arises in your life is an opportunity to understand what we call the true nature of the phenomenon. Now, we're going very slowly through this book that I've tried to write called The Cost of Illusion. And as I said in my email to you all, I said, you know, okay, the title of the teachings is the same. I'm not giving, you know, each week a new title to the teachings, because it's a series based on the book called The Cost of Illusion. But the content of the talks, you will see, is quite different each week as we begin to understand the different components of our ego psychology. So, previously we've been talking about form as the first aggregate or the first component of ego psychology. And that is how the appearance of the idea of self and anything other than self arises. And this is what we call basic duality. The idea of self and anything other than self. And in order to have this basic ignorance, basic duality, we've talked about the eight aspects of consciousness. We've talked about the five consciousness that work in relationship to the five senses. We've talked about the sixth sense, which is the conceptual mind. We've talked about the seventh consciousness, which is related to what we call a cloudy way of seeing, and not a precise way of seeing, but it makes us see everything in an unclear, non-precise way. And the eighth consciousness is the storehouse consciousness, which stores all the imprints and impressions of all our actions and reactions to certain phenomena. And so all these seeds that are stored in the eighth consciousness, then they arise under certain conditions, and they arise as filters on our perceptions, so that we have to experience things in certain ways. Now we think we just experience things. Whatever way you are seeing this room and this moment, you think, oh yes, this is the way it is. You look around you at the people in the room and you just look at them. Yeah, that is the way they are, isn't it? Just look. Look at your own experience at this moment. Consider this. Now, how many of you are taking into account the conditions that are necessary for this present experience? No. We don't see it that way. We just accept things as we think they are, moment by moment. This room is... How is this room? To you. Your perception of this room.
Solid.
Solid?
Real.
Real. Any feelings?
Neutral.
Neutral. Yeah. Anything you particularly like or don't like?
Sankas. Very nice.
Very nice. Yeah. Anybody else? What's your perception of the room?
Light.
Light.
Mm. Cool.
Cool?
Cold.
Cold. Yeah, well, you're lying on the floor there, which is really cold. Yeah. Very cold, that floor. Maybe you're lying on the carpet. Doesn't matter about putting your feet.
No.
Anybody else?
Pleasant.
Pleasant. Sherry.
I see countless causes and effects that were set a long time ago for this beautiful moment to occur. And a changing phenomenon kind of way, I guess, was the projection, but...
Yeah. Be honest with yourself.
I see that changing phenomena. This
that is how you see moment by moment, is you see changing phenomena?
When I stop and I look at it, at that moment, yeah. But I don't always stop and look at it, but you're asking me to stop.
Yeah, but I'm asking you to contemplate, but just in general, your perception of this room.
I guess it would be a projection of all of our energies mingling, I guess.
I don't know if you're being so honest with yourself. This is all very idealistic, in the sense of, you know, I don't know. But I don't know if you really see the room like that. You walk in and that's what you see?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, okay. All right, fair enough. But in general, we never question our experience. We never question the components of experience. Now, what makes me see the way I perceive things? We just see it as we think it is. Oh, that's very nice. I like that. I'm not too keen on the brocade. It's a bit fussy. You know, all this commentary goes on. She's a bit strange, or, you know, why is she wearing that silly jacket? Oh, this is, you know, why doesn't she shut up? She always asks questions. Yeah? All this is going on all the time, you know, all this is acting as filters. It's coming up, you know, from all these seeds in the eighth consciousness, which, you know, we don't realize. It's just causing endless filters on our perception, that distort our perception. We never see the actuality of the phenomenon, or what we call the true aspect of the phenomenon, the non-fabricated aspect of the phenomenon. Everything that we've said now is what we call mental fabrication. Depends on ideas, whether it's energies, light, cool, nice tanka, interesting teaching. All mental fabrication. So, now we're given an opportunity to be introduced to another way of seeing. We understand that this is mental fabrication. But there is another way of seeing which is beyond this mental fabrication. And this is basic freedom. This is what we mean by the awakened way of seeing. But we also need to understand how the illusion of what we consider to be our own experience is created. And when we see how the illusion is created, then we're not seduced continuously by the illusion. And remember the example that I gave with the torch, you know, the torch at night. You're with me, we're going to the garden, and I have a long torch with a cloth wrapped around the end, and I dip it in oil and I light it, and then slowly with my hand I make a circle. And then all you see is a circle of fire. The person who comes in doesn't see how that circle of fire has been created. So they might be completely seduced by what they see. Look at that circle of fire. You know. They don't see the conditions that produce the illusion. So they're seduced by the illusion. But the person who understands the conditions knows that it's not really a circle of fire. When this and this and this comes together, then it appears to be a circle of fire. And this is what we're doing here with these teachings. We're trying to understand these conditions. When we put this and this and this together, then this kind of experience arises. So when we talk about ignorance, it's as if we're not willing to go back to see how one came to be ignorant. Actually, one cannot literally go back. and one doesn't really have to go back. So rather one discovers what one was by the process of going more deeply into the present situation. And that's the difference between an intuitive approach and an intellectual one. So intellectually, you can go back, but that doesn't help. You still remain stuck in the same point of view. So the whole idea, if you're able to realize what you are in the present moment, then you don't need to try and go back. So what you are in this moment contains the whole message of what you were. And this is really the practice of non-duality in meditation, seeing your present situation and going with that. And this might be identifying with particular sense experiences of sight or smell or sound. Just experience the simplicity of what is happening moment by moment. If you see what is happening moment by moment, that's it. Many of the various types of therapy that are introduced today, you know, emphasizes about, you know, going back to your childhood, you know, working with your hang-ups. But with the Buddhist approach, that's not necessary. If you understand what is happening now, then you understand the whole mental environment. All these blockages are because you don't see what is happening in the present moment. You don't see the nature of the phenomena. So you get lost. You get lost in what you think is happening, or what you think has happened in the past. Do you understand what I'm saying? Just by intellectually going back and thinking about what happened in the past, you can still be stuck in a point of view. Whereas if you really go into what's happening in the present, then this dualistic fixation begins to dissolve. And we actually see the nature of the phenomena. Just by resting, relaxing, letting go, letting be. And the way we introduce that is the simple method of, I said, just, you know, consider, just relax and consider how the consciousness is moving around the senses. So, moment of seeing, moment of thinking, moment of hearing, moment of thinking, moment of seeing. Okay, again, let's try this just for a few minutes. So, as soon as you notice where the consciousness, which sense door the consciousness is at, if you find just resting a moment on sound, just say hearing. If you notice you're looking at something, just say seeing or form. Smelling something, smelling or smell. If you notice you're thinking about something, thinking, just say thinking or thought. As fast as the consciousness moves through the six senses, then mentally note wherever you are aware the consciousness has rested. Okay? So.
rest.
Very simple, very precise, very grounding, isn't it? So tell me, where is the past in all of that? Yes. Is it anywhere else?
Sometimes you can feel a twinge of pain in something that's where you've had an operation. I guess that's a kind of past.
Again, we're going to look at that. We're going to look at pain in a minute. So then what makes our experience seem so real when we reflect on the past? If all it is a thought.
Your interpretation, it's the ego interpreting, and that's the attachment, and it becomes personal.
Anybody else? What makes it feel so real?
Because it can give you a physical feeling now. Thought, but it can actually give you a feeling in your stomach or your chest or something. Yeah. And that feels in the present.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? What makes it feel so real?
No, sometimes it doesn't seem so real because sometimes things that I remember very clearly about my own past, when I mention it to other people who were there, they can't remember. It's disappeared for them.
Mm.
It's only real for me.
Mm.
Quite upsetting when it's something very important, mm-hmm. sort of significant, and no one actually remembered it except me. But I guess we've all had that experience.
Yes, very often these days my memory has really deteriorated since all this surgery. Francis often reminds me, oh, this happened. No, don't remember it at all. So helpful to do this kind of practice. Because, you know, this is really what is happening. The six senses are the only way we can experience. This is the basis for experience. Gives you a different kind of way of seeing, doesn't it? Very different kind. We put so many different conditions together and make it into one single event. And then we perceive it as something solid, something substantial. And something very real. And then we react to it because we believe that it is real. We react to it either with attachment or aversion and indifference. So let's look at this first skanda, very basic. And then we have feeling and perception and the rest of the skandhas. They're all built on this basic idea of form. Again, form means the idea of self and other than self. So we could say there are different types of attributes of form. They're around form, they're built around form. So fundamental experience begins with relativity, with the notion of comparison. And what does that mean? It means ego and its projections. Now please consider what I'm saying very slowly. It's not easy to digest this. Again, let me repeat this. Fundamental experience begins with relativity, with the notion of comparison, which means ego and its projections. So we cannot experience anything without somebody to experience it, and this is the starting point. Very basic. How can you experience anything unless there is someone to experience it? So experience only functions in duality. Any questions?
You mean the Buddha doesn't experience?
Yes, the Buddha doesn't experience in the way that we have an idea of experience. Go on, then we'll have a deeper understanding of how this functions. Now, we cannot experience anything without somebody to experience it, and that somebody is an unknown person to us. It's an unknown factor.
So you're saying we've never discovered our basic relativity?
we've never discovered. We have no idea about relative truth. We have no idea about conditioned existence. Everything is interdependent. Depends on conditions. So that somebody is an unknown person, but experiencing it feels good. We don't know what is experiencing any phenomena, but somehow it feels good. And that is ignorance and the ego. Because we keep wanting to feed this unknown factor, this unknown person, this unknown idea of self. When we actually look for it, we can't find it. I like this. I don't like this. Oh, I think this is so boring. When we actually try to look for this idea of self, it has no basis. If we look through the body, we can't find it anywhere. You know? It's not in the hand. If it was in the hand, we'd be able to cut it off. So this is why we do what many people consider to be very stupid, naive practices of, you know, okay, let's go through our body and try and find the self. You know, so then we have to go from the top of our head down to the tip of our toes, up and down, trying to find this idea of self. What is it? Is it the hand? Is it the arm? Is it this? Is that? Is it the lung? Do I take out my lung? Do I get rid of myself? You know, all of this only to help loosen our ideas, which we are habituated to believe in. We believe, I am what? What?
A human being?
I'm a human being, okay? All right. Go on. What am I?
I'm here.
I'm here. Okay. What is here? When you refer to I'm here, what do you refer to?
My body.
Your body.
My speech, my mind.
Right. Now, when you say I like being here or I don't like being here, now what word is that? What's that? Where's that I? Is it just a thought?
Some experience.
It's a condition. It's a thought that's been lacquered and layered for so many, many times. So it feels very solid.
It feels very solid, very real. So it has no basis, really, does it? Does it have any basis? I like this and I don't like that.
It changes.
There's nothing that you can hold on to and look at as a self there, is there? Yes, sir?
Well, even as I get older, I see how much my preferences and values change all the time.
Okay, so is there anything we can hold on to? No, so there's no basis, is there?
I don't know, I mean, don't you hope you can hold on to some basic ideas about morality?
I'm looking for the self.
But sometimes you define yourself by what you won't do or what you will do.
I'm still looking for the self. I'm looking for what is it that likes or dislikes. Because it causes so many problems. Yeah. If we don't like something, then in some way we're going to try and push it away from us so we don't have to deal with it.
There's something that would die if I stopped eating.
There's something that would die.
If I stopped eating.
Okay, so that's basically you're coming back to the body. Alright. But there, here we're looking at, it seems to be two aspects of the self. The self that is related, relative to the body. I am sitting here. Relative to the body is sitting here. But then we have this idea of self, which I hate this. I can't stand being in the room with this person. Now, where is that self? Is that the body? If so, which part of the body? Investigate, because we believe so much in this.
What is the personality then? It's just who is the personality?
This is what we're looking into.
I'm trying to find the master author who writes the fiction in our minds.
This is what we're looking into. We're looking at all the conditions that make this feeling of self so real. So solid, so substantial. Because as soon as you have a self, really, just look at this. As soon as you have a self, you will have an other than self. Because you have an other than self, there must be something here to perceive it. This is basic logic. Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah? This is it. This is what we mean by duality. This is four. And this is not enough. Just this feeling that there is something here, perceiving something there. That's not solid enough. We have to build on it. And then we begin to construct more and more. We put all the psychological building blocks in place so that we really feel there is something here and something there. Let's go on. Okay, so the first step, naming and labeling. Why do we name things and label things? In order to begin experiencing yourself. That's interesting. Yeah, we'd never think of, you know, that is the reason that we actually name and label things, is to experience ourselves. So, in order to be able to experience one's own position, and this is the starting point of comparison. All right? We wouldn't think so. This is the trick. The trick of ego. Remember how we're working with the definition of mind. And the definition of mind that I'm using as a basis for these teachings is this mental process that creates an object in order for a subject to feel that it exists. So instead of creating the idea of self and then the projections of self or ego, here we're looking at it in a reverse order. We're creating the phenomenal world, this objective world we think is objective, in order to really solidify that there is something here, perceiving something there. So the more we see the transitory and transparent nature of the phenomenal world, correspondingly this idea of self will begin to melt. Right? This is why we keep examining the phenomenal world. Is it really the way I think it is? And the more we see that it is not, it is just a mental fabrication, then at the same time we will see that this idea of self is also a mental fabrication, that it has no basis. There's nothing for the ego to play with. Remember, it's the ultimate relative. The ego is the ultimate relative. Ego and its projections. We're not just working with this idea of self. We're working with ego and its projections. Okay, when we talk about skandhas or the translation for skanda is aggregate, or it's sometimes translated as a heap, or a pile. Okay. So that means each skanda is not a definite object like a stone. But it's a collection of a lot of little details or aspects of psychological inclinations or tendencies. Okay, so we're not looking at just one thing, but lots of different psychological tendencies. And we call this an aggregate or a scandal. So when we talk about the scandal of feeling, which is the second scandal, it's not solid and it's not just one feeling. It contains all sorts of feelings. And then the third scandal, perception, this is the same, and so on and so on and so on. So it's these heaps of many psychological tendencies put together, and we call it feeling. Alright, this is clear. It's not just one feeling, one type. Many different psychological aspects involved in this aggregate. So we could say the ego is made out of a lot of particles rather than being one fixed thing that keeps going on. And one would not normally see the sixth sense consciousness as the first skanda, but in our ordinary understanding, when we think about the senses, then one would already begin talking about perception, and yet perception is the third skanda. So let's look at the process that takes place in a fraction of a second of consciousness. So we could say what we're talking about here is something like a 500th of a second. 500th of a second. Imperceivable. So what happens? First, we have an impression of something, which is kind of blank, nothing definite. Then we try to relate it to something. And all the names that we've been taught come back to us. And if we have a previous experience, we put a label on the thing. You brand it with a label, and then you know your relationship to it. Then you like it or you dislike it, and depending on your association with it that comes from the past, now this first kind of blank is made up of a millionth of a second. This is before we put a label on anything, right? Before we categorize anything, before we have a relationship with it. And this is the meditation experience of what we call the primordial ground of our own consciousness. Before we put a label, before we define anything as anything. Then, the next instant, there is a question. You don't know who, or what, or where you are. So then, the next moment is a faint idea of finding some relationship, and then you immediately send a message back to the memory, to the association that you've been taught. And then you find a particular category or a particular label you've been taught, and you stamp it on. And then at that is your strategy of how you're going to relate to it in terms of liking or disliking it. This is all happening in fractions of a second. All this information that's coming together. So the whole process happens very quickly. It just flashes into place. And you're not aware that actually the five skandhas are present in that fraction of a second. All these conditions are coming together. And this makes up your experience moment by moment. Now, let's go on to the second skanda, feeling. The second stage of the process, feeling. Now, what is feeling? Here, we're saying that feeling consists of the pleasurable and the painful. And in the usual psychology of most people, pleasurable experience relate to as something positive, yes, and something creative. Look at your own experience. Is that how you see something pleasurable? Would we consider something that we regarded as bad, pleasurable? Not really, no. So then, look at this way of relating to the phenomena. Pleasurable is something positive. Why would we run after certain things if we didn't find them pleasurable, or we didn't think that they were pleasurable in some way? Whether it was going for a walk in the fresh air, or going to the cinema, having a drink, meeting friends. Why would we do these things if we didn't consider them to be positive in some way, creative in some way? Sit on a chair.
Yeah, you
don't have to force yourself. Please tell me, how do you experience things? You think it's fair to say this? That we consider pleasure to be positive?
I think it's one-sided though, because sometimes you do things which are not in themselves pleasurable, but you feel that it's a worthwhile thing to do.
But that's positive,
yeah,
isn't it?
But it's
because
not necessarily pleasant to do it. You know, there's lots of things that you do that are not pleasant to do.
But in the long run, it will bring you some pleasure.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It's like when you go to the gym, you don't like doing it, but you know you'll feel better later or get a better shape.
But if you do something for other people, for example, or I don't know, go on a march or do something like that, I mean, this is not a pleasurable experience generally. It's not unpleasant, but it's not actually pleasurable. But I mean, I guess it depends on the reason why you do it. If it's involving your own ego, or if it's for a more altruistic reason. But I mean, I think, you know, there are reasons for doing things which are not just a matter of personal pleasure.
They are, though.
It depends on your, I mean, you have to
so
check your own
your
motivation.
Your whole way of thinking about the situation that you don't see as you. All your conceptualization about the situation, the fact that the march is positive, the fact that you're doing a good thing, that's all it's all a perspective. perspective, this little reflection of you. And you think it's something good and something righteous.
Mm.
So there is some pleasure, there's self, if nothing else, there's self-reinforcement.
But it's not, it's, it may be self-reinforcement, but I think it's not necessarily pleasure. I mean, pleasure is a very, I mean, it suggests hedonism or, you know, personal enjoyment. I mean, I think it's rather different from the reason why we do a lot of things. I mean, you know, it's like, why is Quok taking such a long time to carefully setting up the recording, you know? Is it for your own personal pleasure? I mean, why do
no,
you
No, we're not
that?
Saying that.
No.
We're saying that pleasurable experiences are usually considered to be something positive.
Mm.
That's what we're saying. We're not saying...
But I was thinking, I mean, maybe, you know, experience of setting up... This is neither pleasurable or not pleasurable, setting up all the whole recording thing, but, you know, but it's something positive, but it's not...
No, it still is pleasurable for me, because I know I can get it done. So
yeah.
It does have some feedback, because if I know... can't do this, I won't do it. It's going to be a struggle.
I think in some cultures, pleasure is looked down upon, like modesty and humility are more like the shift of like the idea of what pleasure is either looked down upon and not rewarded, depending on the cultures that you live in. Certain behaviors are accepted as norm, and what you might think is pleasurable might shift. It might not be positive because you're indulging too much or something like that. And I think it's really, it's subjective, maybe.
Okay. Well, I'm not talking about everybody. I'm just talking about, in general, I think when we consider pleasure, we consider it as something positive. And when we consider pain, right, then we consider it as something negative or destructive. I'm not saying for everybody, but in general, I think our psychology functions like this. I'm not saying I'm right, just saying, please consider this, yes.
The voice of Melanie.
Yeah.
The voice of thank you.
Channeling
Melanie. Okay.
Why does feeling come before perception?
Hmm?
I'm never really honest. Why does feeling come before perception? How can you have a feeling about something before you can feel it?
No, because you're thinking of perception in very different terms than perception is meant by the scanner of perception.
Okay.
Yeah. So when we get to that, then you'll see it's not just our normal way of looking at perception. The development of relating to things in terms of positive and negative values is an extension of the basic pattern of ego, which is established by form. So, having already the basic form, which seems something definite and solid to hold on to, then we go a little beyond that, and then we try to identify this form as a best frenemy, a best friend, or best frenemy. That's a new word, isn't it? A frenemy. That's lovely, I'm not sure.
First,
there
was equanimity, and now there's
frenemy. I had a teacher who always used to say, in all seriousness, that was nice. So now we have a frenemy. All right. So then we try to identify the fall as a best friend or an enemy, and then it's considered to be something threatening or something welcoming or seductive. This effect of solidifying whatever it is even further, it's something that defines ego's position. So form provides a background. This is composed of rudimentary names and concepts. Positivity we relate to as good feelings, purity, beauty, power, or whatever you consider to be positive. Now, you have ideas of what positivity is, don't you? What does it mean to be positive? You tell me, what does it mean to be positive?
To see the goodness in
anything. To see the goodness, I think. Well, anything else?
That's different for everybody.
Okay. Give me some ideas, positivity.
For some people it's helping others, or for some people it's smiling, being kind.
Okay, kindness.
Being beneficial things.
Beneficial. Meaningful,
mm-hmm.
pure, godliness.
Yeah.
Okay. But we have concepts.
Yeah.
We have concepts of what it means to be positive.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And we also have concepts about what it means to be negative. So tell me, what's negativity?
Destruction.
Okay. Anything else?
Selfishness. You're just asking for a personal?
Personal. Of course, that's all we can talk from, really. Personal. What do we consider?
It just depends on each person.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm asking. You as your own experience, when you say something, think something is negative.
Ill intent.
Ill intent.
Yeah.
Okay. Something negative. What arises?
Hunger. Hunger.
Could be, yes. Person, yes. So, let's give a more general term, not just hunger. What other names could we give for this?
Not enough to eat.
All right. So, not having
what we want.
Not having what we need to survive. Yeah. So that, what does that imply? What comes up with this?
Pain.
Pain, right? Pain.
Desire. Greed. I mean, the fact.
Greed. Okay, that comes up with not having enough to eat. Means people not willing to share. Yes, because there is enough to eat. Yeah.
But it wouldn't seem like, well, if you were starving, wouldn't really be greed.
No, I'm talking about, you know, when we think of hunger, then, you know, also this idea of greed comes up, because some people have so much and others have nothing, yeah? Concepts. Unfairness. We have an idea of what's fair. How things should be. And then we relate to that. Everything is related to that idea of how things should be, how people should be. To be a good person, then that person needs to be this way. Yeah? Okay, I'm just asking you to examine your own experience. So then painful, negative could be painful, evil, destructive. Now what's interesting is the first, the idea of positivity in this teaching is connected with birth. And negativity is connected with death. When we usually talk about death, then for many of us, there is this underlying feeling of something negative. And birth is a joyous occasion, yeah? Very positive. Oh, look at that new baby, great, great. Look at that dead body. Yeah. I often say, you know, there you are, a lovely little baby. You're not going to do that to a corpse, are you? And yet that lovely little baby is a living corpse. Dzogchen Rinpoche, that's what he used to say, you know, he'd say, look at all those living corpses. Because they just weren't utilizing their lives. Living corpse is the great expression. So these dualistic criteria, or we could consider others such as hot and cold, are the starting point of feeling. So feeling in the sense of the second skanda cannot function independently of this criteria of something relative. All right? That's how feeling functions. Only on a relative standpoint. So feeling in this sense of something which is much more fundamental than just pure sensation. So all kinds of concepts develop on the basis of feeling. Feeling's kind of basic dualism. Alright, so we have positive, negative, and then there's a third possibility of indifference. And this is the kind of antennas that go out to feel form. We have this basic form, and then the antennas of feeling go out to the form, and then we have to categorize the form. Just by categorizing the form, positive, negative, indifferent, that gives substantiality to the form. It feels more solid now. There's something out there. And because there's something out there, then, of course, this feeling of self is now becoming more solid. Can you see? Very interesting. Very, very interesting how this mechanism works. So positivity, negativity of feeling is elaborated in terms of mind-body situation. So feeling solidifies itself in terms of these two fields of experience. Feeling relates to mind as emotions, and to the body, we could say clusters of instincts. Okay? Relates to the mind as emotions, and to the body as clusters of instincts.
What do you mean by instinct?
I'm going to go on and explain this. Yeah. So understanding of the mind-body pattern of feeling is very important in connection with meditation. This is why we do these simple Vipassana methods of, you know, let's look at what's happening, just to get more precise in our perception of changing phenomena. So we can meditate either intellectually or intuitively. And meditation on the intellectual level is involved with the mind side of mind-body, and it's very imaginary. And intuitive meditation engages with the body level of feeling, particularly bodily sensations, pleasurable sensations, or pain in the legs, or hot and cold temperatures in the room, you know, something very basic like this. Now, mind is seen as emotional, imaginary, and it has a kind of dreamy quality about this, and this is also feeling. Body, in this case, is also a quality of mind. That is, we do not, in feeling, experience the body as it is. We never see our body as it is. No, we would not consider this, would we? We have a version of our body, but we never see the actuality of the body.
You mean from the inside out?
No, we just do not see the body as it is. We have an idea of the body. We see the body as something solid. We don't see the components that make up the body, do we? No.
Lots of heaps.
Lots of heaps, yeah. Lots of collections.
Otherwise, why are people so freaked out when they watch operations? They can't bear to watch people being cut open. And you can think like, oh, that's right there, me too.
Yeah.
That's true.
I remember telling you, you know, my Monday morning meditation in Thailand, because we had to go down and watch an autopsy. Monday morning. Mm-hmm.
They made you do that?
Huh? Yeah. Monday morning, this was what they did. All the bodies over the weekend, you know, all frozen. And then they take the bodies out of all these drawers that they keep them in. And then it's amazing to see they have these electric saws. And they kind of zzz, cut through the body like that, and then peel back the flesh. All this external idea of the body is peeled back. Some of the Thai monks would actually faint.
But not any
Annie. Super Annie. No, I didn't faint. Yeah, we have a very solid idea of what the body is, and this is why we have all our attachment and desire. You know, I always jokingly say to people when they say, "Oh, isn't she beautiful?" I always say, "Why don't you turn her inside out?" See if she's so beautiful. You never think of doing something like that. You have an idea. Beauty. That's, you know, seductive. All right. So we experience our version of the body, and the fundamental point of view of ego is based on a kind of comparative criteria. The definite separation between this and that, and this is already operational. So then there's a kind of basic twist, which is already there from the first skanda. The what we call the unobstructed space of things is already distorted by the time we get to feeling. So, as I said before, you know what we've done in the first skanda is we have frozen space into form. In order to have this and that, we have frozen space into form. Our essential nature, open, spacious, unobstructed. But somehow, because we cannot deal with the speed of changing phenomena, through this, what can I say, not being able to assimilate what is happening, then our tendency is to freeze space, and then once we've frozen space, then we have to secure this illusion that we have created. And the only way we can secure this illusion is by constantly creating more and more mental objects that we can relate to. And the more solid we feel these objects are, then correspondingly the more solid we feel ourselves. Are we getting the idea of this mechanism? Anybody not clear of this mechanism yet? It's not easy. We need to listen to this over and over again. Remember the ice cubes in the bowl of water? When you see them in their frozen state, then they seem so different from the water itself. It's only when they melt do you see their own nature. So now we've created things all the time through these appearances. We've given them identity with our names and our labels and our categories and our feelings. We make them into things. So now we have thingness. There's me. Thing. There's you. Thing.
But doesn't ice have a different nature from water? Doesn't ice have a different nature from water?
You think so? Nature? Then how can it dissolve into water? Think about this. I'm not a scientist. I can't tell you the actual components of. Because something appears to be different. Is a wave different from the ocean?
But I would say a mango tree is different from an oak tree. An ice cube is different from a flowing water. But not all the time. Well, in a certain time. I mean, at a certain time, a mango tree or an oak tree might actually be a bit of earth. Could both come from the same bit of earth. But at some moment in time, they're different.
say anything?
Well, ice is water. It's just in a different form. Because how can it melt and then become water? It has to. Ice is water. It's just in a different form or condition. And so therefore, when it melts, it goes back to another condition. It's a changing phenomenon. So they are the same thing. They're just in different states.
But if an oak tree is cut down, it can never become a mango tree, can it? It can't morph into the other thing.
It could go into earth and then grow into mango tree.
But without a mango seed, it wouldn't become a mango tree.
Yeah, well, don't get lost here. We're going off. No, it's just an example. Excuse me. Never mind, let's keep going. Anyway, we have this tendency to pick up on things and don't give ourselves time to digest what's being introduced here.
Do you think that the naming and labeling always called the full reaction? In every case? I suppose it's very rare that we would encounter an absolutely new phenomenon. I think we might still react to it even though we have no basis in which to compare it to.
I think we'd have to put some category on it. We would have to define it in some way in order to react to it. Don't you think?
If you simply say I liked it or I found it pleasurable, I think without possibly having any basis for that. I don't know because I haven't encountered any new phenomena recently, but if I did.
Could something really arise without you having some concept of it?
Aren't you constantly reacting?
Yeah, I am. That's what I'm saying normally. I'm saying theoretically. I'm saying theoretically. An alien lands there.
You'd label it as an alien.
No, an alien. I'm speaking from the alien's point of view. Let's say the alien has a thing and it sees a tree, but there's no trees on its planet or any plants.
Yeah.
Maybe it might. Do you think it couldn't have a reaction to like or dislike the tree without having any basis, without having encountered any kind of vegetation?
Yes, but we seem to encounter new people. And then I'm just saying, we seem to encounter people that we've never met before. We don't know anything about. And yet.
Well, I'm saying that if you've never even encountered a person before.
Excuse me. I should turn it off. Hello? Yes? I'm right in the middle of a teaching, Lorraine. I can't talk now. Can we talk later? Thank you. Okay, bye bye. That lovely lady who wants to go.
Advertising for Nokia.
Hmm?
Get advertisement for Nokia.
There you go.
Buying for Nokia.
Yes. The path.
Oh, it's Nokia.
Okay. Yep. So I think we just have to look at our own experience and then see more how we react to things.
I think if there's an alien come along and never saw a tree before, they will say, they will look at it as a scientific point of view and what makes it, the component of it. They'll dig, leave, whatever was it. But when you actually, and then they probably give it a name after. Like, first human come along, see. Experience first and then you label it after because you sort of experience it like first caveman saw a berry. And they have no label for it, and they taste it, and it's good, and it's black, and put a blackberry.
Right, the feeling that it's good would come from the label. I would have thought that the reaction comes first,
and then the label.
Yeah,
after.
I'm arguing that that's possible, whereas we're saying that's not the case.
It's a baby.
right, for some for a being that has that encounters a phenomenon that I have never encountered before, that has no basis for.
You have no reference point.
Yeah,
well,
so
you'd have no, you'd have no response.
Mostly we have reference points.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't have.
And you'd be making that theory based on those what's familiar.
You
know,
I'm saying that you don't have. I'm saying that you do not have.
If
you have absolutely none.
But how is that possible?
What if a rabbit
well,
had
is it? I'm saying, is it possible? I mean, okay. It is possible.
So what if a rabbit had wands?
Theoretically, it's possible.
All right, you tell me next week. You consider this. What's your reactions to things? And then tell me how it works. That's the way to learn, isn't it? You know, not because I'm giving you a concept about things, but look at your own experience, how you react to things. Different phenomena arise, and then why do we feel, you know, pleasure or displeasure, like or dislike? Where does it come from?
I have looked at that. That's why I'm asking this question.
Yes, we can only learn. We can only learn by our own experience.
Isn't there a reference? There has to be a reference to that feeling or something. There's always a reference. You have to create a reference.
Don't agree.
Okay.
Is in its world in order to create an opinion on what is on that world. I think this is the hypothesis. But in order to describe something, usually we have references.
And
we
pull out
to describe it in order to like it. That's why I'm here.
You could like something without. Knowing what it is, you
can
like
this?
Yeah.
You like something without. What about the baby the first time it tastes chocolate? It's never had anything sweet before.
I hate chocolate.
Well, chocolate's generally considered. Okay, so it might hate the chocolate or like it, but it doesn't know what it is. And it's never had anything sweet.
No, not this sweetness in mother's milk. So there's always going to be some reference point that's wondering.
Let's say
you don't.
Let's say you give a chocolate before milk.
Possible.
It's the same with things.
It's gonna like it or not like it.
I'm saying you can either like it or dislike it. I'm not arguing you have to like it. I'm just saying that you can react to it without having any reference point. I think.
So babies react to things all the time, I suppose. Without all that reference point.
Right.
But then maybe their reference points are past life imprints.
Perhaps.
With things, with bodies, if a baby touches a flame, of course it doesn't like it, and it's nothing to do with it knowing what it is, or it's we're bodies, we are bodies,
mm-hmm.
and our body does have survival mechanisms.
I would say the body could be the reference point, wouldn't it? Really,
yeah,
the vehicle.
You know,
the body's a vehicle.
Let's say the body is a threat. Let's say it's not a situation where the body is threatened.
I find it difficult to separate the body and the.
Anyway, I'm not giving you an answer here. This is we're learning through our own experience. We need to come back to our own experience. We're so used to being fed answers that we never really examine what's going on. You know? So now we're given the tools, we're given the opportunity to actually look
at what makes up experience. So please, you know, let's try this week. Let's take a look, and then you can give me some other answers. Right. So when we talk about feeling, then we usually think in terms of feeling towards someone else. You fall in love with someone, you're angry with someone. And in that imagery of the other person is all important, and you are insignificant. Please consider this. When you feel something towards someone, you fall in love with them, or you are angry with them, then the other person becomes all important and you become insignificant. Okay. On the other hand, if you feel that you've been ignored, or you want to be loved, in that case, you are all important and the other person becomes insignificant. See how the focus changes here. So feeling plays a kind of game here, a kind of introvert-extrovert game of making itself important by reflecting off other. Yes, very interesting. But when we look at the actuality, then all this seems to be very remote. Nobody is actually involved. Only you. You are alone and you're creating the whole game by yourself. Yes. So there's really nobody out there. You know, it's just totally going on in your imagination. This person is wonderful, this person's like this, oh, you know, if I could be with that person, if I could live my life with that person, if I could spend even just a night with that person. That person is just terrible. How arrogant. How insensitive. Who do they think they are? Talking to me that way. They should be, you know, they should be like this. What's going on? Where's the other person here? And we play this game constantly with ourselves. This is relationship. This is what we call relationship with other people. Is our imagination. So if we understand feeling, it's very revealing about how we relate with things. And feeling really is the pretense that you're involved with somebody. And actually, we're just beating our head against the wall. Look at our own relationships with other people. Look at all the suffering that we go through. Not only suffering, but pleasure. Why do we have all these ups and downs in our relationship? We
what's actually happening? What causes the ups and what causes the downs? Again, come back to these six senses. What is the cause of the ups and the downs? Preconceptions. Which sense store is that?
Our thoughts,
yeah. It's not something we see or hear or taste or smell or feel in terms of tactile sensation. It's just what we think. And thinking in this sense is imagining.
We take it all very seriously.
We take it all very seriously. Everything is very real. That person is actually like that. As soon as there is the feeling that that is like that, you empower it, you give it a sense of reality, then that is the basis of your reaction. Otherwise, if you don't believe in what you think, you don't react.
You might be able to have some fun.
Hmm?
You might be able to have some fun.
You might be able to have some fun. It'd be a lot lighter, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The relationship would be a lot lighter, more playful, probably. Because you know you're just bouncing off. You're bouncing off. You're reflecting off the other person. Yeah. The other person is just a mirror for you to see what you're doing, what the imagery is doing, projections are doing. So you learn. You learn from the relationship. It's a support. Support for your growth, for your understanding. And then more compassion arises through this openness. Willingness to see. Because now we don't want to see. Really don't want to see. Don't want to let go of the way, our habit of perception. Because we get a lot of feedback from these ups and downs. If we feel good, there must be something to feel good. If we feel bad, there must be something to feel bad. So we could say that the Buddha Dharma is an atheistic teaching. And so our journey is a kind of a lonely journey. There is nobody who's going to save us. There's nobody that we can pray to outside, to come along and show us what we're doing. The teacher, again, is the symbolic teacher, just helping you to find the inner teacher, and that's your own wisdom. That's all the teacher is. So when we pray, it's not like you're praying to something external. It might seem that we're praying to something external in the beginning. Please help me, please show me the way, please, 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 please. But then, the more we
and work with our own experience, then we begin to see that the Lama is our own nature. So studying the second skanda of feeling can be extremely important in helping us to realize that the whole journey is made alone, independent of anybody else. And yet we're trying to beat ourselves against something all the time because of this habitual tendency of needing to secure this idea of self. And so we're always, you know, trying to hit something, trying to bounce off something. Can you see? There's this need, this tendency, this habit. That's the only way we can secure ourselves. And we have used our spiritual pasts as a means to do this as well. And now, these teachings are saying, no, that's not the way. That's not helping you let go of anything. You're just holding on to this habit, but you've given it a different clothing, a different disguise. Using your spiritual path as a means to secure yourself, your idea of self. I'm a this, and I'm a that, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. I'm better than you because I practice, and you don't practice. And I should be like this. I'm not worthy. And all this other shit. Yeah. I don't know, we just keep going. We think we're doing something else, but we're holding on. All these tendencies still there. We need to see what we're doing, and then we can let go. If we don't see what we're doing, we just keep going. Same habits.
And sometimes it's hard, even if you think you see, you interpret it in a different, your ego maybe interprets it in a different way, so you're not even being honest with yourself. That's what I find sometimes. You treat yourself with that.
Yeah, but it's okay. That's once you understand that we have these tendencies, then this is the starting point. This is good news. You've got to know that you're confused in order to work with your confusion. Otherwise, you don't know what the path is about. The path is about working with your own confusion. It's not some moralistic religion where we're praying to something in the sky. It's very down to earth, you know, working with our own neurotic tendencies. Hello. It's okay. Cold. Okay, so let's return to mind-body development of feeling. So the mind aspect provides tremendous resources to fool ourselves. We could say inexhaustible resources of dreaming and imagining. This is feeling. Look at feelings. Look at anger, desire, jealousy, and all this other emotional conflicts that come up.
how much imagination is involved in these feelings. Yeah? Look at something that's pissed you off this week. Anything. Anything that you've got frustrated with or agitated with. Why did you get frustrated and agitated? Because you got lost in this imaginary process that's going on. This is like this. And this is what is happening. And this is wrong. And it shouldn't be like this. It should be like that. Otherwise, there's no fuel. There's no fuel for the emotion. I think for some of us who have done drugs in the past, then or alcohol, you can see how different, under different conditions, the way you see things changes so much. A few drinks. A smoke, or a this, or a that, whatever it may be, changes the way you see, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've been wondering recently. I've been seeing, because Christmas and New Year, a lot of drunk people around, and some of them have this sense of freedom.
Hmm?
They have this sense of freedom. Some drunk people, when they're not, they're at one point where it's not too crazy, and how great it would be if we could all walk about like that with our alcohol and have the same sense of freedom, where we don't care what people think about us, and we don't have, you know, our inhibitions are not a big problem.
Inhibitions are there for a reason, aren't they, though? To make you livable with other people. I mean, we all just did what we thought or said what we thought. It's a nightmare.
We don't take it seriously, it's not at all a nightmare. We just laugh.
Well, I don't know, I'm.
What are you doing?
The wrong person, no inhibitions there.
What do you think? You think Maria's right? If we all had that opportunity to walk around without any inhibitions, it would benefit.
That's what Mr. Chalice said when he was here.
Huh?
That's enlightenment, to be free of inhibitions. But it's a losing of the self somewhat, isn't it? When you've had something to drink, and you finally, there's a slight release of your perception of yourself, or your feeling of an inhibition of expressing who you are, and therefore this is, but I think we all have to be in the same sense too.
Well, I mean, if you still know that you're part of everybody, you're not going to start just saying, you know, things are going to happen. Yeah. People, you're going to be very aware of that, but at the same time, you're going to be very different.
I don't know if I want everyone kissing me, though, if I don't know.
Oh, you weren't saying that then. I'm
joking. Like, seriously. New Year's was, they were kissing the total strangers, and it was
really
wild. I didn't necessarily want to be.
It was germs. It was
germs. It's not for everybody.
Craving for attention from one person to another.
Yeah.
What do you think, Luani? Because I've been thinking about that when I see some drunk people, and I think, why can't they be like that?
Like what?
Why can't they have that sense of freedom? Because there is a little bit of a sense of freedom. Why? And I said that to some of my friends who drink, and they were just looked at me like, what are you talking about?
But are they all Brits, Maria?
Yeah,
it needs that to get them. It's not like losing emissions, it's just becoming normal. You know? I'm on two, you know. I mean, massive losing of emissions, we're like saying something to a stranger, you know.
No, we're talking about doing foolish things and not really caring at all.
That is why people drink and take drugs.
Yeah, this is what I mean, and when I see them, I keep thinking, why can't this be strived for without that?
Well, why don't Italians need to get pissed all the time? Because they can be normal without it, you know, in Brits.
But can they be normal? Can they really walk about without... I mean, what's normal then?
Italians drink. But not, you know...
It's more than just inhibitions.
Yes.
It's much more than just inhibitions.
But that's a start.
I think honesty is a start, yes. I mean, basic honesty of looking at, you know, what we consider not only positive but also negative about our psychological traits, habits, accepting ourselves, mm-hmm. Not always wanting to present something to somebody in order to be accepted. We are so afraid to be rejected. We are so basically insecure that we have to create all this fabrication all the time in case we're not accepted. And you know, if you're ignored, how you feel. Or if somebody, you know, says something that you don't think is fair, you know, how do you feel? That's not me, I'm not like that.
So would it be fair then to say that if I'm reacting to someone who criticises me, to that criticism, the depth of my reaction that I can see in myself is how insecure I am, whereas if someone criticises me and I don't react that much, obviously that person is feeling more secure internally.
I think, you know, you can listen to people's criticism and you can consider, you know, whether that's valid or not valid without getting upset.
But you can only do that if you're a certain something inside, right?
Well, you have to understand that the way that person sees is a projection as much as the way you see that person is a projection, the same thing. So you just look at what the person is saying and consider it in a very open way. It's like these teachings, nobody's forcing you to accept anything here. It's just, let's consider, let's contemplate, you know, whether this has any truth to it at all. And the only way we can see that is by looking at our own experience, the way we react to things. You don't accept things just because another person tells you that's the way it is. This is what we've done all our lives, and this is why we're in the state that we're in now. We just don't see clearly because of all the conditioning, what we have been taught and never examining. Well, is that the way it is? Is that really? What's the basis for that? How does it work? We just don't examine. So we need to watch out for spiritual materialism, and that means relating to our experiences, even, you know, our meditation, in terms of reinforcing this idea of self, or in terms of benefiting the ego in some way. So, spiritual materialism tends to associate anything to do with spirituality with a kind of dream world or heaven. And I think, you know, those of us who saw Zonza Kenzie's video last week, you know, we have an idea of heaven, an idea of enlightenment as where, you know, everything is perfect, everything's much better than the way that we see things now. A dream world where everything functions. And then, you know, what he was saying brings you very much down to earth. Well, in your dream world, do you have a door? Do you close the door when you go out? Why do you close the door when you go out? Is it because you're afraid that somebody's going to come into the house and take something? Or that a rat is going to come in and steal your food? Enlightened way of seeing. Would it be necessary to close the door? Would it be necessary to have a door and four walls? You understand? Our idea of enlightenment is a better place. At the moment, our idea of enlightenment is, you know, a better place. Our idea of heaven is a perfect place to be. What does that mean to us? What does a better place mean? What are we striving for? To be awake, to see. See clearly. So then, in the talk, he brings you down to earth. And he just said, you know, in this idea of an awakened way of seeing, do you still have a door? Do you still have a need to close the door? Why would you close the door? A very interesting question. You know, why do we close our door? Because generally there's fear that something will come in. We want to protect ourselves in some way. We want to protect our property, protect something. There's an element of fear. We lock the door, double lock the door, treble lock the door, everything. The body aspect of feeling is associated with the actual relationship with things. So the element becomes more and more vivid when we talk about the next skanda, perception. And we'll focus on that later. The experience of actual things, thingness, of solidity and stability. And this is not solidity and stability as it is, but our version of it. We think it is solid. Very important to consider this. It's not that it is solid, but we think it is solid. Causes us many problems. Our idea of solidity.
and stability. We think it is solid and we think it is a thing. And still relating with this body aspect of feeling, then this can really open things up when we understand that solidity is just a thought. Our version of solid. So suppose suddenly we get sick and we feel a pain in our body. The body is a thing made out of all kinds of things, therefore pain in us makes us feel a relationship with the actual reality rather than imagining something beyond it. So pain arises in the body. And at that moment, it brings us down to earth. Yeah? It's there. Then what happens?
React.
Then how do we react? Do we leave it like that as just bodily sensation?
Very difficult.
Very difficult, isn't it? So then what do?
Zoom in on it.
Zoom in, yeah, all right. Zoom in on it. And then how do we do that? Then, come on, let's have a look.
Our mind, our attention goes there.
Yeah.
Then other things get locked out. And then we try to alleviate the pain in some way. But it's our thoughts and our mind and everything is then focused on that area.
Yeah. So how much is imaginary and how much is actuality? We don't consider this.
Actually, this is something I've thought about a lot.
You know?
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot over the years about like how much of the pain is just sensation and how much I put on top of it myself. And it took me a long time to realize that I was adding so much of my own story on top of just the sensation. If you can just leave the sensation as sensation, it's not nearly as bad. We layer upon layer of ideas and worries and anger, irritation, frustration.
So in this kind of situation, when we're feeling pain, then, you know, most likely somebody will come along and sit with us and say, how are you feeling? Oh, I'm sorry, you still got a lot of pain. You know, but just think, if you keep going, if you keep exercising, you know, then in a few weeks you're going to feel much better. Not going to last, you know. So then immediately you're going into this imaginary realm of feeling.
We make it real. We make the pain into something real for ourselves. It's a process. We create it ourselves.
Yeah. Make it into something solid and unchanging. Yeah. We don't want to see that it's changing. Even though, you know, our friends or somebody's telling us,
oh, you know, it's not going to last. It's going to change with a bit of exercise here and doing this and doing that. Of course it's going to change. They're telling you the true aspect of that.
There's something about us that wants to hold on to us.
Yeah, it gives us attention.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember saying to a friend of mine years ago, she was in a lot of emotional pain because of something she'd done. And I remember saying, well, it won't always be like this. And she said, don't come here and tell me this. This is not helping me. Because she wanted me to be there while she was in pain, not be telling her anything else.
Sometimes we want to be distracted, and other times we don't want to be distracted because we're getting so much out of the pain, so much feedback from the pain.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the pain itself is making us feel so secure.
And it gives us a sense of being.
This gives us a sense of feeling. I exist. I'm feeling pain. So then we don't want to be distracted from that by somebody, you know, saying next week you're going to feel much better. Mm-hmm. Another, you know, remember the tendency, the need to secure this sense of self. We're using everything that we can get all the time.
People in America, young kids who hurt themselves.
Sorry?
Actually, you know, kids in America, teenagers cut themselves.
Do they?
Attention seeking and a way of feeling you're alive or something.
Yeah, so it's good. It seems good, you know, when somebody comes and tries to take us out of the pain instead of just letting us, you know, experience this raw physical situation that we're going through. Kind of the other person hopes that we're going to believe in what they're saying. Kind of get lost in this imagery that we're presenting to the other person. Yeah. Oh, you know, it's really not so bad. Yeah, really, you know, remember in the past, you know, it didn't last. And this, look at those people around you, they're much worse off than you are. You know. Trying to get you lost in the imagery instead of just sitting with the sensation, which is changing moment by moment. So we never get, you know, hardly ever get that opportunity to just sit and see what is actually happening.
That's true. And the whole medical world is designed to take you away from it.
Yeah.
All of their attention, all of the energy is put into getting rid of the pain or finding ways to mask the pain.
My doctor's great. He comes round and he says, anything wrong? I can't say a word. Because he always says, there's nothing I can do about it. Okay. Right. Here we are again. It's not going anywhere. Now you know, you've got all this metal. It's not going anywhere. You can't change that, you've got to work with that. That's very interesting. Before, when I didn't have all the metal, then I felt that the body was far more flexible and less solid. And you know, now with all the metal there, it makes you feel pretty solid.
Cyborg.
Okay. Once we're in the world of imagination, in which we can imagine how beautiful it is beyond our physical body, then we're also connecting with the imagination of how terrible the pain could become. So there's two aspects to pain here. One is how wonderful it could be, or how terrible it could be. And both we get lost in this imaginary aspect. So we get lost in the world of wishful thinking and unwanted thoughts, and somehow relating directly with the body aspect of feeling goes much more away from the direction of what is actually taking place. So feeling happens with concept, but as it happens, then the whole movement becomes confusing, and the concept does not apply anymore. Okay, let's stop here today. Any questions? I think it would be good if we just sit for 5 minutes or so. And as I said, four people that I've heard of have died this week, and I'm sure many, countless thousands of people have also died this week that I haven't heard about. There's so much suffering and confusion in our world. And it would be wonderful if some way we could ease this suffering and confusion.
and we dedicate all this positive energy that we've accumulated here, so that each and every being can find happiness and the cause of happiness, and be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. This is our wish, our aspiration. Say some prayers. If you look in the drawer over there, the top drawer, I think, then we have the long line of prayers from the teachers. For most of you, you don't know these teachers, but we pray for their long life. The first prayer that we have on this page, usually we start with the prayer for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. We pray for his long life, and then we'll do the short rebirth prayer. So we pray for the swift return of Shagra Rinpoche. Those of you who've known Rinpoche, who visited Lama, who came here twice during his lifetime. So I feel he's already back, but anyway, we still say some prayers so that he takes rebirth very soon and continues to benefit all us beings here. And then we do the prayer for my root lama, Chinyin Norba Rinpoche, the prayer for Zonza Kenza Rinpoche. So it's not the order that you usually do them. What is the order that you usually do them? Rodney's usually the one who
Rodney always starts with a long rebirth prayer.
Your team doesn't start with the dedication prayer?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do the dedication prayer, prayer of aspiration, the auspicious wish, and then we'll do the short rebirth prayer. And throughout my many lives and until this moment, whatever virtue I have accomplished, including the knowledge generated by this practice, and I will ever attain to my noble sense of being. May sickness, war, famine, and suffering be decreased for every being, while their wisdom and compassion be increased in this and every future life. May they receive all experiences in the substantial of the dream fabric of the night, and instantly awakens to perceive the pure wisdom display arising of every phenomenon. May I quickly attain enlightenment in order to work ceaselessly for the liberation of all sentient beings. Buddhas, lotus temples all together, whatever kind of motivation you have, whatever kind of beneficial actions, whatever kind of wish for prayers, whatever kind of omniscience, whatever kind of life accomplishments, whatever kind of benevolent power, and whatever kind of immense wisdom you have, then simply I, who have come in the same way to benefit beings, freely attain these qualities. At this very moment, for the peoples and nations of the earth, may not even the names disease, famine, war, and suffering be heard,
Rather may their moral conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase, and may supreme good fortune and well-being be recognized. Amen.
Now, how do you feel yourself? Would you prefer to say these prayers in English, or do you mind saying them in Tibetan? What do you feel?
We're used to the Tibetan.
I pray that by the blessings of the powerful and wrathful Vidyadhara Pena, in whom the Sugatas of the Three Jewels and Three Roots all unite, the rebirth of Tenagadi Wancho may swiftly appear and bring vast benefit to the teachings and beings. Long life of His Holiness. Gandhi Gandhi Huwe Shinkam Su Kandam Dewe Mangu Tuwe Ne Chenre De Wanten Zeni Dasu Ye Zephe Kapya Bandhu Kangyu Shim. And the realm surrounded by rings of snow mountains, you are the source of all benefits and happiness without exception. Powerful Avalokiteshvara, Lord of Compassion, Tenzin Geshe, may your lotus feet stand firmly for hundreds of eons. Can you all remember she? Om Soti Jime Hushu Tupe Meruka Sewa Rizim Teme Donzopa Jinle Samzanda Ve Wong Tolchan Kele No Hui Pasu Zantan Shu. O Haruka, accomplished in the true conduct of fearlessness, you carry on the family line of Dhamma, the holder of intrinsic awareness, power over longevity, and your activity holds the strength and power of the courageous Lord Secret Bhadrapani, glorious gem of virtue and excellence. May you stand firmly. Utterly radiant sun of the wisdom of Manjushri, the all-pervading rays of your innate compassion shine forth without limit. Their superb energy and power nurturing the lotuses of the teachings and beings. May your three sublime secrets always remain firm. Longevity prayer for all Lamas. Tenze Jue Echimpo Jamayo Rinne Bandang Trepa Zempe Jehunam Kuchen Jalsan Tanju Shem. That the teachings of Lord Buddha is the source of benefit and happiness long remain in his soul. And the life of those who uphold the Buddha's teachings be a stable and victory banner. Dispelling of obstacles. Embodied
embodiment of the Buddhas of three times. Guru is great bliss, Lord of all accomplishments. Guru is the dynamic and wrathful tamer of Maras, dispeller of all hindrances. I pray to you, bestow your blessings. Please remove all our inner and secret obstacles. Grant your blessings that our wishes be spontaneously accomplished. Amahum Vedru Guru and then prayer for the tradition of Guru Pema Sambhava to flourish. The master of Pema Sambhava and the king Trisandits flourish and pervade the three realms. May the presence of the three jewels never be separate from the life streams of being, and so ensure sublime well being throughout the three times.
Thank you.